Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network. On Monday, November 26, 2012, I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on the Progressive Radio Network. Every Monday live from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 a.m. to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.fm.
Today you're going to hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today. It's going to include, how does music affect surgical patients?
And music to your ears for insomnia.
And which popular sleeping pill quadruples the risk of falls in the hospital?
And what personality type is most likely to respond to placebo?
And here we go again with mammograms. Are they good? Are they bad? Are they in between?
You'll see. The controversy continues.
It never ends.
And if you'd like to join in our conversation and have questions about our topics or your health, give us a call on Mondays from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time or 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time on PRN.fm at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Last week, we talked about the benefits of the music our brains make translated from EEGs, those are electroencephalograms, and MRIs, helping us to move from an anxious state to a calm state, which is also archived in video on our fast tracks on drsaputo.com, along with all of our topics on Prescriptions for Health Radio.
You know, I think a lot of our listeners don't realize that we archive these shows in video. So if you want to see us and what we're doing when we're presenting this, go to drsaputo.com and there it will be.
Yes, each topic is about like 5 minutes.
It's a nice synopsis of about 5 to 10 minutes. That's right.
This week an article came out showing the benefits of music on surgical patients. And another regarding a device used to rebalance the brain with musical tones to treat insomnia. So first, let's talk about this surgical Kentucky study.
Okay, that was a good study that came out. That what they found, basically, is that, and this was published in the Southern Medical Journal, by the way, this last month, is that they examined the use of music in the pre-op, intra-op, it means during surgery, and the post-operative stages of the surgical process, and found that music had positive results in all of those stages. Less sedation was needed in the way of medication. People were less anxious. They felt better. They reported they were really satisfied with what happened.
They had less pain.
Yeah. And, you know, there were studies that were done before that showed that if you do guided image before surgery, that it actually lessens your blood loss during surgery. So what this is pointing out is that what you think in your mind has a powerful effect on your biochemistry and physiology and determines a lot of what's going to happen to you in the next whatever time.
The study even showed that it reduces cost and time for patients that are in ICU.
Right. So people go home earlier and they just feel better.
So what types of music are suggested or would you suggest?
Well, it depends on who the person is, but I think generally speaking, things that are calm and slow and gentle get the best results. But if you're somebody that likes rap music, it could be that that will work for you.
And you know, too, I was thinking sometimes the surgeons operate to music, and it might not be the kind of music that works so well with your particular brain or preferences.
Well, that's really true.
Even if you're unconscious, at some level you hear this, you see.
I think we don't
realize.
And
your brains respond to it. So maybe it's a good idea to ask ahead of time, because you did that when you had your hip surgery. If you can bring along
a CD
and play it in your own earpiece.
Yeah, no, it's a great way to go. I remember I work with a website called Aurelis.org. It's Aurelis.org. And this fellow from Belgium did this, and I've Skyped with him a number of times now. Really good guy.
Isn't this a form of auto-suggestion?
As opposed to guided imagery, what happens in guided imagery is that the person who's doing the guiding of the image that he's put there, he or she is putting in your mind, is that they give you options and choices. Where would you like to be? What does it feel like to you? And you make the decisions of what it's like, so you're sure to pick the things that you like.
Sometimes with me, though, when I listen to things like that, I get stuck on trying to think it up. And I get stuck on trying to pick my best choice, you know.
Might do better with guided imagery.
I think I do.
Well, the healingmind.org is another site that's a good one. That's Dr. Martin Rossman's. And he started the Academy for Guided Imagery back in the 70s. He's been working with this ever since. And he, too, is a good friend of mine. He lives out here in Marin County, California, where we do. And his work has been sensational at helping people prepare themselves for all aspects of what happens during surgery. And I think what this article is trying to say is that it's really a good idea to partake in something like this because you're going to have an easier time. I mean, when you go to surgery, let's face it, you got to be a little revved up because your life is in the hands of a surgeon that may be, you know, listening to something you don't like or have a personality that's not quite the same as what you'd like. And if you could get calmed and relaxed and do better, why not? I mean, I think it should be a standard thing in surgery.
Other music that we've recommended before, too, is Stephen Halperin's music.
Oh, I love Stephen's work. In fact, we listen to it all the time here. Because it really gets you into a mood where you can concentrate better. It's amazing how sound influences the mind so powerfully.
He has music for all different kinds of things, you know, even for being in the car, for relaxing, for, like you said, for trying to concentrate. I don't know. He has a long list of things. It's easy to go to his website, and then you can just check out the ones that appeal to you.
Yeah, it's Halperin, Stephen, Steven. And I know that when I'm not in the mood to do something like we have computer work we have to do, or we have to prepare something, we'd rather do something else, I just shift the music and I find my concentration goes right with it.
And then also what we talked about last week, I don't know if you could get a hold of your own brain soundtrack, though.
Well, that's a little more complicated. And if you happen to have an electroencephalograph machine and a functional MRI at your home, you got it made.
But you know what would be so perfect is if the hospitals would do this for the patient, you know, if they would offer the patient a playlist for sedation or sedative-type music, you know, and then let the patient pick from that list the music that they like, and then do this all automatic, and then just have that playing into their ears during surgery.
Well, see, they should be doing that all the time in hospitals. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in a little while as we talk about the effect of how you get people to sleep easier. But I think that every hospital should be geared to patient comfort and to making them feel as good as they can. Because let's face it, you go to the hospital, you don't feel very good most of the time. If something wrong with you, it has to be major, you're not going to be there. And anything that can be done to make you relax more and to feel a little bit better, maybe in less pain or having some other thing, symptom that you have be taken care of, should be done. Because really hospitals are geared for doing things to people, for doing procedures and tests. And it's understandably has to be worked out so there's a schedule. But, I mean, you don't really have to get up at 6 in the morning to be weighed or have, you know, some things done through the middle of the night.
Well, you know, complementary alternative medicine has been using music for a long time. And I think it's, you know, even piped into the hospital in the background would just be nice for all the patients.
Well, I do that in my office. I mean, why wouldn't we do it in the hospital? And how about having an environment that's a little bit more pleasant? I remember years ago, hospitals were really not geared that way.
Well, what I was trying to get at was massage therapy. You know, when you go for a massage, they play music in the background. And it's very unusual that they wouldn't. In fact, not long ago, I was going to have an appointment for some massage therapy. And all the power went down in our area, and it was at night. And I called my massage therapist, and he says, well, you want to go ahead anyway? He said, I have, you know, like a...
candles.
we had a battery-operated light, and some candles. But, you know, he thought that the music was important. And what he did was that he turned on his cell phone, his smartphone.
Oh, and played it there?
And he found music on his cell phone and played that in the background.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, and I thought that shows how important that he thinks that music is in the background when you're having body work done. And then also think about the convalescent hospitals. You know, many times churches have their choral groups go and sing, or kids come and sing Christmas carols. Or tell the story about your mom when we went to go visit her in the hospital.
Oh, my gosh. My mom has been oriented to music her whole life. You turn on something she likes and she starts dancing. She might do that in the middle of a place where you wish she wouldn't, but she did. And when she was in a convalescent hospital, because she had lost a lot of her health, and my brother came in, who was singing with a choral group for some of the patients in the convalescent hospital, she was kind of asleep when she was with us.
We came in, and we couldn't even rouse her.
No, right. And she heard the music, and all of a sudden she perks up, and she starts acting like a conductor. I mean, it was amazing what the power of music was. And, of course, music has been something that's been powerful throughout all history of humanity. Sound and rhythm and music.
There are lots of healing sounds, too. You know, that's one of the things that Stephen Halpern has with his music.
Mm-hmm.
And also dolphin sounds.
Whale sounds, yeah.
And waves. And some people, you know, can do well with crickets and the creek or the rain or whatever.
Sure.
So whatever it is that makes you feel good, that's the thing to listen to.
Well, for sure. I think getting your mind focused in the moment is what happens, is because the music sort of captures your mind, and all of a sudden you're right there, and the rhythm of it is something that your mind craves. And as you follow that and continue to live with it, it's a pleasant experience.
I know when I had shoulder surgery after an accident, and before the surgery, I had been planning, the week before it, I guess, mm-hmm. I'd been planning the surgery, and I saw somebody that did guided imagery. And so we did a tape of guided imagery. And so I would listen to it in a bathtub with candles and some essential oils. And I would listen to this tape that I had with the guided imagery. And some of the things that were in it were to make your mind visualize what was going to be happening under the knife, and to make it better, like you were mentioning earlier, like that there would be less bleeding and how everything was going to go smoothly, and to visualize it all that way. And another time, too, when I had some dental work done.
Oh.
Because I used to get so nervous. You and I both had horrible experiences.
Well,
when
I think we had the
kids.
Same dentist, who was just brutal.
And I didn't even use it. My mother told me not to use Novocaine, so I had a lot of cavities when I was a kid. And I had a lot of Novocaine. And I didn't have any Novocaine, and I would just grab onto the seat handles and look at all those dots on the ceiling, and I just freeze up, and it was awful. Well, anyway, it carried over to my adulthood, and I'd go to the dentist, and I'd be gripping onto the handles and scared and tense, anything but relaxed. And I started bringing a CD with me, and I would put that in my ears. Now, I know some dental offices have that. Some dental offices even have videos and things, you know.
Well, my dentist even has a foot massager. He's called the transcendentist, which means he's combining a little bit of transcendental meditation with dentistry, which I think is a great idea, because for me, the experience was just like Vicky was talking about here, was really not pleasant. And I've gotten myself to a place now where a lot of the time I don't even need anesthesia anymore. I just sit there and I know what's happening, and I'm relaxed. I'm into the music or the video or whatever's happening, or even the foot massage. And then all of a sudden, I'm in a place where the pain isn't a huge thing, and I can kind of go with it.
And you don't even get the Novocaine.
No, I don't even do it anymore. So it's there's so much involved with sound and rhythm that is good for us. And I look at the effect of ritual. Another thing that really takes you to a place that's very special, where you're centered in the moment. I think a lot of these are centering devices that take us so that we're not multitasking, and including pain is one of the things that we're focused on. Because fortunately, the human mind, we're not that smart, and we can only be in one place at a time. And if you're in a pleasant place, listening to something that you enjoy, that's capturing your presence, that's a very good thing, because then you won't be focused on the pain so much.
Maybe you could have a Bluetooth in here and be having somebody talk to you on the phone.
Well, that might be a little harder.
Well,
but
I was thinking about driving. You know, why it's one of the reasons why it's not safe to drive and to be talking on the cell phone, because you can get so involved in your conversation that you don't even know where you're going.
Well, I think that's part of it. But I think the hands-free part there is the most important. When you're trying to look at your phone and or text or try to dial a number, it's not a safe thing to do, and it's something we shouldn't be doing.
Well, have you ever been in your car and gotten to your destination and stopped and thought, how did I do this? How did I even get here? I don't even remember.
When I was going to University of California in Berkeley to school at the university, I used to drive to work a lot of the time, and when I did, I don't even know how I got there. It was just like automatic pilot. It's amazing what you can do when you're half asleep. It's a miracle.
You know, if anybody has any questions about their health or they want to join into our conversation, this is live.
Yeah, well, that's true.
And our number here is 888-874-4888.
Right.
You might want to write it down, 888-874-4888.
Right. So I think in this whole topic of music and its effect on surgical patients, it's something that needs to be studied more. I really love the idea of the article that came out that we talked about last week that combined the electroencephalogram with a functional MRI and actually made music out of the two that sounded very exciting because it could change the way you felt. And you know, the fact that Homeland Security was looking at that and has studied that is a little bit frightening to me, because I've got enough paranoia about what Big Brother is all about. And that whole topic is frightening, because you can be manipulated without even knowing it. So if you don't even hear the music and it's subliminal, it's going to have an effect on you, much the same as pictures do. Like on your television screen, if somebody wants to slip in a couple of extra pictures, they're going to change how your mind responds to it. And we've got enough trouble trying to have limited government that it's a big challenge. I'm not much of one who wants to see government take over everything we're doing, because all of a sudden things like this come into play, and it's just kind of scary. So
Well, also, you know, with this other study that came out this week about how music helps insomnia, think about how that can apply to having surgery, because that's what you want to do, is to be asleep during the surgery, which is one of the reasons why it makes it so in the study, so that they didn't have to use as much sedative.
Yeah, well, I think all kinds of things are possible, because the mind is like a big pharmacy. The body is like a big pharmacy. We make millions of reactions occur every second in our body to keep our cells functioning properly. And if something goes wrong with that, we lose our control of whatever it is that's being done, and it has devastating effects. And the positive aspects of this are just remarkable, because our body can respond physiologically, biochemically and physiologically, by producing the exact amount of hormone or some other substance that you need in your body to be able to function normally.
And the other thing, too, is we were mentioning about how it helps to reduce stress. And I was thinking about Pete Wilson when he had his hip surgery.
Oh, yeah.
And he ended up dying.
He was a
table.
News broadcaster, very popular newscaster in Northern California on KGO. And he was having a hip replacement. He was absolutely freaked out. This was a few years ago. And when he was planned to go to surgery, the night before, he went to the emergency room and said he was afraid that he was going to die in the surgery, and he wasn't sure he should do it. And they just patted him on the back and did an EKG.
Yeah,
he did. And he was in no shape to go to surgery, but they took him to surgery anyway because he had scheduled it and they want to change it. And so what happened, of course, for those of you who know the story, is he died on the operating table the next day. So, and that was just for a hip surgery.
And see, his EKG said that he was okay, according, you know, that's what they thought. But we've heard other stories about people, too, that have had an EKG and then they ended up dying of a heart attack. So those aren't always the best tests, I guess.
Well, that's right. Well, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. We're opening up the lines at 888 888- 877-474-4888. So give us a call if you have a question about your health or what we're discussing. And now it's time for Vicki's first 2020 tip on November's Maxine. And when we come back, we'll talk about music to your ears for insomnia. So stay with us.
We're going to be talking about November's Maxine. You know, since we fell back to standard time and it gets dark earlier now, Maxine says, don't forget to turn your clock back. I'm going to turn mine back to when I was 20.
Oh, all right.
If it got dark any earlier, we wouldn't have to get up at all. That reminds me of Alaska. You know, Alaska days are really short and you don't realize how much you plan around your daylight until it changes like that. And it's different that way, you know, in the summer, too, with so much daylight. In fact, it doesn't really get dark in the summertime. It's like the sun goes down, but it doesn't get dark enough for a flashlight. And I have a son that lives in Alaska, and when I go to visit him, that's when I realize how much of our life is centered around night, about light and dark.
Absolutely.
And we don't even realize it
until
we're in another situation like that. Okay, back to Maxine. They hold elections in November because it's the best time for picking out a turkey.
Oh, jeez.
Voting,
that's true.
And voting is like choosing your favorite mosquito out of a swarm. And how about global warming? How do we know that global warming isn't just Mother Nature having a hot flash? Fall makes me grumpy. In that way, it reminds me of winter and spring and summer. Oh, and trust me, tight fit jeans and loose fit skin are one bad combination.
Oh, jeez.
And then when I drive, my travel mug is no spill, as long as I no drink out of it.
As long as I'm not driving.
And now that winter's around the corner, it's time to prepare. It's time for a snow tire recall. I can't recall where I put them.
Hmm.
When I was a child, my dad would wake me up by saying, rise and shine, and the sun is shining, and he'd open my curtains, and he'd hand me a glass of fresh squeezed orange juice.
Wasn't that nice?
It was nice. And Maxine says, I can rise and shine, but not at the same time. And last but not least, Maxine says, ever feel like you've had too much coffee? Me neither.
Mm.
So be who you are and say what you feel, because those that matter don't mind, and those that mind don't matter.
Yeah, good advice.
Yeah.
Well, Maxine's kind of funny. And humor is the best medicine. Thanks for that, Vicki.
Well, I think one of the things that's good about her is she's so outspoken.
Well, that's right. Okay, so the lines are open. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. The number is 888-874-4888.
So, more on music. You know, we have some music to your ears for a good night's sleep. With 50% of America suffering from insomnia, it's common to try everything from warm milk to melatonin to sleeping pills to get that shut-eye. And researchers have found that musical tones to balance the right and the left brain activity can actually reset the brain and reduce insomnia. So what is brainwave optimization and how does it work?
Well, it's a fancy name for EEG neurofeedback, actually. And what that means is that when the brain has been traumatized in some way, either through stress or through an injury of some kind or a stroke or some kind of disease that affects the brain, is that the balance between the left and the right hemispheres goes off, because basically what you have is two parallel processors, the left and the right hemisphere, that's connected by a lot of nerve fibers called corpus callosum. And when a person undergoes a lot of stress, there's a autonomic response that happens very quickly that leads to one side having a lot more activity than the other. And when that happens, we have a hard time concentrating. We have a hard time repairing if there's some damage that's done, and we have a hard time sleeping. So these people published an article in a journal called Brain and Behavior this past month that when the left and the right brain synchronization is off, The trauma that develops, that causes insomnia, can be fixed by playing sound waves of a certain frequency, and it's like pushing the reset button on your computer when it's frozen. So all of a sudden, things start working again like they're supposed to and in balance.
So in other words, the resonance between the musical tones and the electrical energy in the brain brings balance to the two hemispheres.
Yeah, that's, so when they play the sound, they go on ahead and put that in a in earphones so you can hear it, and the brain kind of auto-calibrates into relaxation. It's pretty neat. You can do it with magnets. You can do it with light. You can do it with high-frequency radio waves. It's a very powerful technique that is not commonly used. It's not widely accepted in most hospitals, but I use it regularly for my patients who have had head trauma and people who have had strokes, because it does remarkable things to rebalance what's going on there.
How do you do it?
I send patients to people who are specialists in this, and usually it takes about 15 or 20 treatments.
This is called neurofeedback or EEG biofeedback?
Yes, I call it EEG neurofeedback, but that's exactly
so
what it is.
So this is similar or
this
the
is
same?
Exactly the same thing, except somebody's patented it, and they call it brainwave optimization.
Oh.
So it's good. And in this particular study, what they had was 20 people who they gave 8 to 12 sessions for 60 to 90 minutes with this musical tone that was based on electroencephalogram frequencies and then played back through these earbuds. And that's when the brain auto-calibrated into relaxation. It was pretty cool.
Well, that's a lot like that study that we were just referring to that we talked to last week. But that, on that study, they made music from the EEG and from the MRIs.
Oh, functional MRI, that's right.
And they made music of our brains.
Yeah, and the sound.
The brain waves, I guess.
Yeah, the sound is very interesting because it shows, it gives you some kind of idea of how the brain works, its speed and the duration of the different sounds that it makes, at least by transcription, the way these particular scientists from China did. So this whole business of sound in health is becoming something that's major. We know that sound and vibration frequencies have a powerful effect on how we think and many things that happen in the universe. We're connected by resonance, so it's great. We're getting away from the Newtonian physics and into quantum physics and the quantum effects that occur.
What's the difference between Newtonian and quantum? Do you know that?
Yeah, well, you're looking at, you know, the apple fell on Newton's head, and when that did, he got the idea that there was a rate at which the apple fell. Well, there are a lot of things that we can measure that are at a gross level, at a macro level, and that's what Newtonian physics is built on. But quantum physics is built on small particles like atoms and electrons and quarks and things of that sort. And the rules of science that happen there are much different than the rules that occur in the macro world, like when you're watching an apple fall from a tree. Or
of course, the apple falling from the tree might go faster according to how high up it is.
There you go. See, you'd have been a good Newtonian scientist. This whole business of quantum physics being involved with it and sound being an important part of that is something that's really important. So that's what some of these articles are trying to tell us, and it's why we decided to put some of them together to talk about several of them in one show to give you an idea of how powerful the effect of music is on our feelings and on how we operate.
And we want to remind you, too, that, you know, all the things that we talk about on our show, Prescriptions for Health, are archived also on PRN.FM, but also on DrSaputo.com, as well as our Fast Tracks. And our Fast Tracks are little short videos of each topic that we discuss.
Yeah, so they're between 5 and 7 minutes long. And you get another
way. Video.
Yeah, it's different than listening, which is great. But if you'd like to see us while we're doing it, go to DrSaputo.com.
Or if you want to just focus on one aspect of it instead of going through the whole show after you've listened to the whole radio show, if you want to go back and just focus on one part of it, you can do it that way
or
also.
Or you could do something like put insomnia in the search box, and what will come up will be maybe 150 videos and audios that we've made over the years that we think fall into that particular category. We'll give you a good idea of what insomnia is all about, many aspects.
And also on our show here, you have an opportunity for almost like a free doctor visit if you want to call in with any of your health questions. You don't have to just call in about our topics. And the same thing goes on our website, drsaputo.com, because what you can do on that is have a free health assessment.
Right. The site's completely free, by the way. No charges for anything there. It's time for a PRN.FM station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The lines are open at 888-874-4888. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health radio on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be talking about what popular sleeping pill quadruples the risk of falls in the hospital. So stay tuned for more Prescriptions for Health radio. Listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Now, here's a way for hospitals and doctors and drug companies and medical technologists to make some money. Just give hospital patients sleeping pills that make them fall so that the money spent on the x-rays, the scans, the lab work, the pain pills, the longer hospital stays.
You're being a little rough.
With possible complications like blood clots. Ambien isn't just seen on TV for over-the-counter use. It's also commonly prescribed as a standing order for sleep in hospitals, and it's been found to quadruple the risk of falling.
You know, you sound like a little radical there, but you're right. The bottom line is exactly what you said. Now, nobody will fess up to that's what's happening, but a lot of that's true. I mean, why would you use a pill that to help people go to sleep and then put them in a state of mind where things can go wrong and make a lot more complications for them that bring a lot more business to the hospital, even though I have to say I don't think anybody who writes an order for Ambien is thinking, well, this is going to be a problem and it's going to make more money for me in the hospital.
Well, you said that's just the way it is, but you know, as a result of this study, the Mayo Clinic is now phasing out Ambien.
Well, that's what they're saying.
They said they're moving towards sleep enhancement techniques that are not based on drugs that they think are safer and probably as effective.
Well, see,
which is a big step for them to say that.
That's exactly right.
But it fits with their study.
Well, of course it does, because it's right. And it's not just Ambien, it's every other drug, too. It's even things like Benadryl. You know, studies have been drawn on the antihistamine Benadryl, and that certainly causes problems as well. And there have been plenty of articles written on that and say you shouldn't prescribe Benadryl to people who are in the hospital.
Well, unless they're having an allergy attack.
Well, yeah, but I mean for sleep.
And look at for sleep. That's crazy to do it for sleep. But I know people do that just because it's a side effect of Benadryl if it makes you sleepy.
Well, that's right.
But remember in the days that all the patients in the hospital were on Valium? That was like standard protocol.
Yeah.
And it had an accumulative effect. And by the afternoons, all the patients were asleep.
I know. But well, it makes it easier to work with, doesn't it? So there's something about the convenience of drugging somebody to relax them. That is what everybody's doing, at least then.
But sleep is really important when a person's sick. I mean, it's important anyway.
Well, you can't repair, right? And you can't rest if you don't have sleep. You don't have that deep sleep. Your immune system won't work right. If you miss 4 or 5 hours of sleep for one night, your natural killer cells, which fight against cancer and viral infections, will be suppressed about 30%. Sleep is extremely important and should be one of the most important things that's brought to patients who are in a hospital.
We need to get back to back rubs. We need to
That's right.
incorporate this brainwave music and these healing sounds. And then there's breath machines. Like we have a healthcare practitioner at the Health Medicine Center in Walnut Creek.
Yeah.
And she has a breath machine, and you use that when you were in the hospital where you listen to
it's
your
amazing.
Own breath and it helps you.
It's absolutely amazing at how that entrains you into your breath and gets you into a place where you're ready to go to sleep. And look at all the side effects that you see with a drug like Ambien. It can cause headaches and nausea and vomiting and dizziness. And, of course, it can cause ataxia, which means that your balance isn't right. You can't walk straight. And maybe that's part of the reason why people fall. You can have hallucinations.
Walk in your sleep.
If sleepwalking, exactly. And if you take it for a long time and then try to stop it, it puts you at risk for developing seizures. I mean, these drugs, I mean, every time you listen to a direct-to-consumer ad, you're listening to the just a litany of side effects that occur that we just, like, tune out to.
Well, you know what I think? Almost all the patients' rooms, unless, I guess, you're in ICU or CCU or something, have television monitors in the rooms.
Right.
At night, instead of, you know, the patients lying there watching game shows or whatever they're watching on TV, how about putting meditation video CDs in there, you know, or guided imagery CDs,
sure.
DVDs in there.
Sure.
Some sort of
relaxation
videos on the room TVs. I think that would be great at night. It doesn't have to be a video. It could just be the sound coming out, or pipe it into all the patients' rooms anyway.
Well, that's right.
But, you know, the other problem is that hospital staff has vital signs to take and work to do. And so what happens is it interferes many times with the patient's rest time and sleep time. So what's more important, to take their vital signs or for the patient to sleep?
Both could be done in a way that's more convenient for respecting people's sleep.
Yeah, so maybe they could be adjusted that way, unless, of course, somebody's critical and you have to keep taking them so often. But many times now, you can have it just happen automatically.
Well, that's why I have places like ICE Intensive Care Unit or in stepped-up units where there are more nurses for the number of patients there, because there you can do a lot more to control how people are, including how sedated they are, and that's safe. Look at some of the things that happen if you fall. And you may fracture a hip, and maybe 20% of people or 25% of people that are older that fracture a hip will die from it. And some of the problems are like blood clots, because your blood becomes thicker and more coagulable, and those clots can break off and they go to your lungs and they can actually kill you there by causing pulmonary emboli. And how about the head injuries of people, you know, who have fallen? There's nothing like an old person who doesn't have much balance to start with that you give a sleeping pill to, and the next thing you know, they fall and hit their head and have a subdural hematoma, and they're in surgery having a blood clot evacuated from their brain.
And many times people are given a pain pill with the sleeping pill.
Oh, that just complicates it.
Or an antidepressant and a muscle relaxant.
Well,
and
that's
they're given
right.
All these things at once.
I mean, people in the hospital, out of the hospital, they're over-medicated. But when you look at people in the hospital, the over-medication gets even more staggering. And some of that is because it's difficult to manage people that are in the hospital sometimes. But it also makes it much more convenient. That's why doctors have this thing called standing orders that they use. So it gets pretty complicated for sure. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final funny 2020 tip on the door. Where'd you come up with that one? Well, we'll see. And when we come back, we'll talk about what personality types respond well to placebo and which don't, and finally about the controversy of mammograms that's continuing.
Ever walk into a room with some purpose in mind only to completely forget what that purpose was?
Yes.
Many times you think, uh-oh, I'm getting dementia or something. Well, it turns out that it's the doors themselves that are to blame for these strange memory lapses.
Well, of course it's the doors.
Well, psychologists at the University of Notre Dame have discovered that passing through a doorway triggers what's known as an event boundary in the mind, separating one set of thoughts and memories from the next.
I see.
So your brain files away the thoughts you had in the previous room and prepares a blank slate for the new locale.
I get it.
So it's not aging, it's that darn door.
Oh, of course.
Thank goodness for studies. I was starting to worry sometimes.
Oh, that's funny, Vicki. Well, I always wondered about that. Now I know the answer. Thank you.
Have you ever had anybody tell you that your pain was all in your head or that it was psychosomatic?
I'm afraid I have, yes.
So how did you react?
I didn't like it because I knew when I was hurting, and I didn't want anybody to tell me that I was making it up.
So who's to judge if it's real or not?
You are. The patient who has it is the judge, because if you feel pain, I'm sorry, it hurts.
And just because a cause can't be found doesn't mean that it isn't real, because it is to you. I can remember one time somebody telling me that it was all in my head because the test came back negative. So what about,
well, that's right.
And then what about stress headaches and stomach aches that are caused from stress? And also, I have a question. If a placebo works, does it mean that you're a hypochondriac?
Well, that's a really good question, because most people would say yes.
Well, what's the real treatment anyway? The drug or the placebo effect from the drug?
Well, aren't they both real? I mean, how could you say one's not real? I mean, most of the effect that we see from the vast majority of drugs that we use in medicine is from placebo. And the drug companies have been very clever about trying to highlight the effect of their drugs rather than the natural defenses of the body that tend to heal us. It's called placebo.
Well, here's a fun study that shows that certain personality types respond best to placebo.
Well, yeah, that is funny. It was published in a journal called Neuropsychopharmacology. And what they found is that people who cope well, that were straight shooters, that were givers, were the ones that were most likely to benefit from placebo. And the people that were angry and hostile, they got the least. Now, I don't know why that turns out that way, but it does, and it's something to notice. And you might think that if you're a nice, good person who's a straight shooter, that placebo would never affect you. But, having placebo is not a bad thing. That's a good thing, because it doesn't cost anything, it's safe, and it works. What do you want? Would you rather take that SSRI antidepressant that probably is mostly placebo anyway, because you know it's a drug and because you've been conditioned to think the placebo doesn't count?
Yes.
What kind of insanity is that?
So how do tests on placebos work anyway? I mean, aren't they used in the trials to test the effectiveness of the drugs?
Well, yeah, it should be the other way around. You should always test for placebo first. And what are the side effects of a placebo? Maybe that it won't work. I mean, that's the worst side of it.
Well, maybe they should only do placebo-controlled trials on certain personality types then.
Well, if you want to make them look better or worse, that's what you do. And don't think that that hasn't occurred to people in the pharmaceutical industry who are trying to make their drugs look good.
Well, I think it's interesting also to note that opioids are released with placebos from our own body as in reaction to them.
Like we talked about earlier, the pharmacopoeia, okay, the pharmacy, the internal pharmacy of the body is extremely flexible. It's far more flexible and way more accurate than all of the drugs that we've developed in the pharmaceutical industry. And that's played like a symphony. A little of this, a little of that, and, the right hormone for this and the right neurotransmitter for that, and it comes out balanced. What we do in medicine is we have no regard for the symphony of how the body manufactures and delivers drugs to our bodies. And that, of course, changed things. It's like playing a symphony with 1,000 bass drums in it. You wouldn't want that. And you'd like to have just exactly what you need.
What about that study that was done with patients that had irritable bowel syndrome, and they were told that they were given a placebo?
On the pill, and the doctor highlighted, this is a placebo. There's nothing but sugar in it, but I'd like you to take it anyway for 6 weeks.
And it helped.
And they all, they didn't all get better, but it was statistically significant that they did. So what's happening in the mind just as a routine thing, even if it's not even something that you would think would make any sense, it's still having an effect. It's sort of like the music subliminally affecting how you respond with a kind of emotion.
Well, belief is very powerful, and we have told the story before about how we walked on hot coals, and that really showed
hot
us
coals?
How,
there were 2,000-degree coals,
yeah,
barefooted.
Really showed us how powerful the mind is.
I remember that whole thing. I was thinking that the person who was my patient that was telling me about it was crazy. I said, you're going to do what? And he said, well, Mr. Smart Guy, I'll treat you to it. You come down and watch me walk on the hot coals, which I did. And as I was there watching Tony Robbins' event there, I was stunned to watch 300 people walking on 12 feet long, 2,000-degree coals, and nobody getting burned.
I know, we did it too. And when I got done, I was sitting on the lawn looking at the bottom of my feet in disbelief.
Yeah.
And people were going by me, did you burn yourself?
Yeah, right.
And it was like, no, I didn't. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. Well, see, it just shows you the power of your mind And I don't care what kind of science you try and figure out that might explain why this is something that's baloney. It's ridiculous. If you got 2,000 recalls and you're barefoot, you're going to have to make up some kind of magic if you've got some kind of physiological way of explaining why you shouldn't burn your feet. Just put your hand in the oven sometime on that metal thing and see what happens. Yeah.
Well, also remember, if you want to learn any more about the placebo effect, we have lots of other audio and videos on it on drsaputo.com. Here's yet another controversial study, and it's also your last chance to call in if you have any questions. It's a controversial study on the value of mammograms, verifying that there are many errors detecting breast cancers that may not be life-threatening and yet are treated as if they are with chemo, radiation, and surgery. And a new study shows that one-third of cancers that are detected through mammograms may not be life-threatening, and we're not talking just the ductal carcinoma in situ that we've talked about so many times. So that comes to 1.3 million women in the U.S. that are diagnosed and treated for breast cancer that don't have it. And that was in 30 years. Mm-hmm. And so that comes to 70,000 women per year that are diagnosed and treated for breast cancer that don't have it.
Overdiagnosed and overtreated. And where is this published? Well, first of all, it's a Dartmouth study, okay? So it's a very reputable university, and it's published in the most reputable medical journal, the New England Journal of Medicine, in November of this year.
And it must not have been funded by the mammogram people.
No, for once not.
So we need to ask, do mammograms save lives or do they put women at harm?
Well, they do both, I think, and the trick is to know when to do what. And as usual in medicine, we get confused, and there are people who just are one-trick ponies, and they just do one thing, and they think that, and they're going to stand and support that no matter what. And the radiologists are really rather close-minded about this.
You know, no matter how many studies come out about this, it seems that they're mostly ignored. And the same thing with the prostate cancer.
Well, that's right.
I think a lot of it, too, is that people are brainwashed, besides the fact that, like you were saying, the radiologists are so geared toward doing mammograms because that's what they know how to do, what they're comfortable with, and what they're experts in. And they're not comfortable doing other tests like breast thermography.
Well, they don't know the first thing about it, but they have an opinion about it, which is what floors me.
But this
it's not like this is something that isn't approved by the FDA. It absolutely was back in 1982 and still is. It's not approved to be a standalone test for breast cancer screening, but that's only because of the politics of what happened, because I happen to know what happened back in 2004 when that came up. It went to the final voting committee of the FDA to either be in or be out. And it was voted down 5-4, and two of the people that voted against it were employed by who? The mammography industry. What kind of fairness is that? That's like an automatic saying it's not going to pass, and yet it's a great test. Now, I think there are real problems with breast thermograms because we don't necessarily have people that are that well trained to read them. And what we should have is our radiologists reading them, but we've got to open up their minds first. They'll take a look at it, and they just simply don't. So here we go again with the same old problem of doing the tests that we're comfortable with. When you do a mammogram and somebody who's a premenopausal, okay, under the age of 55 or 50, what you're seeing is very dense breasts. And in those dense breasts can lie cancers, but the density of the fibrocystic process and of the cancers is about the same. It's like flying over the North Pole trying to look for polar bears. You just can't see them because they blend in so much with one another.
Well, this is why the United States Preventive Services Task Force says that age 50, not 40, should be the guideline for mammograms. And when they first changed those guidelines to not get your mammograms until you were 50 instead of 40,
right, it
just raised all kinds of problems. Well, everybody got upset, and everybody was yelling
about it.
You're
taking away our mammograms. You're trying to save money at our expense, and we're going to get cancer because of that. But Otis Brawley, a physician, okay, who is with the American Cancer Society and one of their top people there, in 2009 when this topic came up, made a big stink about it. He came out with an article in the New York Times saying exactly what Vicky was saying and what I've been saying. And basically, it turns out that within 3 hours, he recanted because he was told by his bosses not to say that. And why would the American Cancer Society do that? pretty simple.
So why
it's
get
it's because they're in bed with the pharmaceutical industry. That's where they're getting a lot of their funding, and they don't want to bite the hand that feeds them. So once again, what we have is somebody who's looking at income and return on investment rather than service for patients.
So why get a test with high false positive results and get conventional treatment when you might not even have cancer? This shows why it's so important to get a second opinion. And besides
that may not be enough either.
Besides that, some of them go away on their own, you know?
Oh, they sure do. There have been some very interesting studies. You look at autopsies that were done on women at age 50 who died from traffic accidents and things like that, and they found that almost a third of them, it was 30%, had a breast cancer that was invasive. So now you're talking about what's going on. 30% of women don't have breast cancers. Well, they did. But what happened is a lot of them just went away because people didn't come down with cancers and they never got diagnosed. The same thing happened when they did a study on mammograms. They studied 100,000 women in one group and 100,000 in another group, and they followed them with mammograms, one at the beginning, one in the middle, and one at the end for one group. And they found 2,000 cancers in that group after 5 years. The other group, they did a mammogram at 5 years only, and there they found 1,500. Where'd the other 500 go? They went away because they weren't being tracked. And a lot of the time what's being diagnosed are these cancers called ductal carcinoma in situ, which is not a big issue. Ductal carcinoma in situ, 97% of the time, you'll die with but not from, because it's the cancer is part of that, is not going to kill you.
So is it the fear and the panic of breast cancer that's leading to all these unnecessary treatments?
Well, it is, and the fear is widespread. It's amongst the doctors as well, because they're saying, well, do you want to take this risk? And it's not like they're saying you have to take the treatment, but they scare you enough that you're afraid not to take the treatment, so you wind up over-treating with chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery when it's not indicated. So we need better screening tests is what that means.
And also in the past, we've talked about these other numbers about how many lives are saved from mammograms. One out of 1,800 mammograms are saved from breast cancer. And two get cancer from the radiation out of those 1,800.
Well, one in 1,200 is going to get a breast cancer from radiation from a mammogram.
So that's even higher than
It would be one for 1,200, so it would be two for 2,400. So it's about one and a half. But even so, I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense, particularly in the women that are younger.
The risk might be worse than the benefit of the mammogram then.
Well, that's what the United States Preventive Services Task Force is saying. That's what this New England Journal of Medicine article is saying. And it's about time we start listening to that and start looking for new approaches that are affordable to do breast cancer screening.
And then the rebuttal tests that report benefit from the mammograms are actually lumping together the young and the old.
Well, that's right. And that's when they say, well, we're saving lives. But a lot of the lives they're purportedly saving are from those people who are never going to die from it in the first place because they have ductal carcinoma in situ. When we start diagnosing more of those, we're just doing a disservice to people. What we need is a test that can tell you which ones of those ductal carcinoma in situs is going to be one that you have to worry about. You know, you want to identify the 3% that's going to be a problem. And it could be that a breast thermography could do that, because what it does is it looks at the problems that occur in people who have cancer from the point of view of physiology rather than anatomy. When you're looking at just tissue densities, like I said about flying over the North Pole trying to find polar bears, that's one thing. But when you're doing breast thermography, you're looking at heat differentials. A test might have, the breast may have densities that are pretty similar for cancers and for fibrocystic disease, but what you're going to see is a difference in heat. And that's where we run into the valuable part of what breast thermography is about.
Because cancers heat up. They have a big blood supply. It's called angiogenesis. So there's more blood supply when you have a cancer, and that's what shows up with a breast thermography.
That's right, because it's where you get heat from is blood. Okay, that's where the heat comes from to heat up the body. So if you see more blood there, that's what's going to happen. You're going to have more heat in that area. So I'm not saying that everybody should do breast thermography. I'm just saying it's another test. But it would be a lot safer than doing a mammogram, especially in women under the age of 50. Now, over the age of 50, it doesn't make any difference to me which one you do. You're going to be about as accurate because the breast isn't so dense, and it's easier to see a cancer in that setting.
As you get older, do you still think you need to have them every year or maybe alternate one year and one the other?
I think it's way overdone. I think if you have a particular problem that puts you at risk for breast cancer, or if you've had breast cancer, that's another story.
Because it seems to me as you age, you're more apt to be getting a or developing a cancer anyway.
You're right. Okay, we're at the end of our show. I'd like to remind you that we'll be back to talk live in What's New in the News, in health, and to take your health questions every Monday morning on PRN.FM and drsaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for health will also be available 24/7 on drsaputo.com as well as PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. Remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe, so if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
We'll see you next week.